Hello there and welcome to The Dip, your twice weekly dive into the global economy. I'm Daniel and Cassandra is still away. She's off hunting Bigfoot in the Pacific Northwest or something like that, but she'll be back on Friday. Coming up, we dig into whether the EU's strong worker protections are behind its mediocre productivity. Controversial. But first, our episode on why food prices are so high gave us plenty of food for thought. So we dug around in our videos on the topic and harvested the following comment from you guys. Let's see, Amilcar Campbell 2405 asks, quick question, when have prices ever reverted back to what they were? Inflation just decreases or increases at the rate at which prices grow. Significant price falls spell bad news for the economy involved. They may slightly dip for short periods of time, but no major reversions. It was such a good question, I put it to the supermarket guru himself, retail analyst Phil Lemper. That's easy for you to say. So, will prices go back down?
There are certain foods that we will see a price decrease. For example, right now, ground beef here in the U.S. is the highest it's ever been, $6.80 a pound on average. Well, that's because we have less cows. So as the cattle ranchers increase the size of the herd, and that takes about 2 years, we will see a temporary dip in prices. But at the same time, again, the feed for those cows continues to go up because of the tariffs. So it's really a balancing act. So we can see some very short-term benefits. I think we're going to see that on turkey, I think, which is up 40% this year. I think we're going to see it on ground beef and steaks. I think we will see it a little bit on coffee and because of the reduction of tariffs from Brazil. But I also think that CPG companies and manufacturers are going to start, playing some games. So instead of having 100% Arabica beans in their coffee, they might have 80% Arabica and 20% Robusta. And the average consumer isn't going to know that. Slight decreases, but long-term prices have to go up.
Thanks very much to Phil for that answer there. And yeah, it looks likely that prices for some things will come down, like he said, but it's a common thing for producers and manufacturers and retailers to defend their margins. So obviously, if they can get away with higher prices, then they will try to do that. We're in an era of sticky inflation exactly because supply chains are so international and the costs are structural and the inputs are global. That's why you have to worry about big issues like tariffs or climate change affecting things like the price of coffee. So these costs won't just fall easily unless you see a change, a big change, a significant change in international circumstances, which would then force producers to compete on price again. Even some things like toothpaste or deodorant, even though they're not necessarily full of international inputs, they still may have sticky prices. Their prices may just stay where they are. And that's because manufacturers rely on brand inertia, that you're going to look at these products and say, well, overall, they don't cost that much anyway, and I know this brand and it works, so I'm just going to keep buying it. So you'll just stick with what you know. That's what they're betting on. But when it comes to things like eggs or the cheaper kinds of cooking oil, those are more generic, so those prices should come down pretty easily. So here's my hot take. If grocery prices don't come down on those stickier goods, we risk seeing overall inflation in the US on everyday essentials normalize at a higher level. So we've got to ask ourselves, at what point does the new high become the new normal? Next up, an intellectual question on the EU. Has there been discussion about the correlation between higher workers' rights and the relatively lower productivity in the EU? Perhaps the productivity per hour may be higher, but other countries like China and Japan have less workers' rights but are overall more productive. Is there a problem with the European culture that champions workers' rights to the detriment of businesses? So basically, are strong workers' rights in Europe behind lower productivity in the EU? We put that to our Brussels correspondent, Rosie Burchard.
Whenever I talk to European Union officials or diplomats or parliamentarians just now, there is one massive buzzword of the moment. It's competitiveness. This idea that it's difficult for European businesses to compete with rivals in the likes of Asia or the United States. And the problems often cited are things like high energy cost, burdensome red tape. And there's a massive legislative push underway just now in Europe to try and make life easier for businesses, less paperwork on things like green rules or supply chain monitoring. But one thing you very, very rarely hear come up in that debate is this question of workers' rights, because it's a kind of sacred cow here in Europe. Parental leave, access to sick pay, protection from being fired for no good reason. Those are things which are not seen as problems here in the European Union, but as protections that were very hard fought for and hard won, and the bedrock of Europe's business environment. That means it's very difficult for governments to try and do any sort of rewrite to those rules. Look how many prime ministers France has cycled through in its effort to try and change its pension system. We will, of course, see different countries tinkering with these rights in different ways. Greece has been looking at extending working hours. Belgium is restricting access to benefits for unemployment. But overall, no major shift is expected. And of course, when Europe says it needs a massive change, it's something that would be very difficult to do. And that raises that question of systems. Of course, if you want to make sweeping reforms, it's always going to be easier to do that in a system where people have less power and there's less democratic accountability. Once a right is in place in a democracy, it's very hard to do it. And of course, workers' rights organisations here would say that is for a very good reason.
Thanks very much to Rosie for answering that question. And, you know, I've spoken to many different business leaders, heads of industry associations in Europe, and they say that workers' rights are far too tough, and that if only the EU loosened them, then they would have a chance to catch up. And now that they're seeing some of their key industries lagging behind the likes of China and the US, if only you unburdened us, then we could make a success of things again. The problem is that they've long said that. They've said that for decades. Even in the good times, they've said that. If only the government would, for example, increase the hours that workers can work in a particular week, if only they would delay the pension age, cut bureaucracy, then they would be able to be the kinds of successes that they have been in the past, or that the likes of Silicon Valley tech firms can be. It is, of course, kind of true that if you remove protections, productivity will grow, will go up. But is productivity really all that you want from a society? Labour rights are intentionally a constraint on businesses. That's the whole point. But it's only one constraint. Labour rights are only one part of this particular puzzle. You've got things like the other constraints that businesses are facing: investment in technology, business restructuring, scale, regulation, global competition. Labour rights is only part of the things which are holding companies back, as they see it from their perspective. And for some of the big European industries, it looks like they underinvested in developing their companies, in investing in research and development, in riskier industries where they could be the first there and they could start to develop while capital and borrowing in Europe was cheap. They could have gone for it then. They chose not to. They paid themselves a profit, or they were just conservative with their investments. And now they are suggesting that labor are the ones that pay for it, that workers are the ones that end up paying for it by having to work longer hours. And so it's understandable why some people see that as fair, as unfair, because remove the labor rights, and of course that's going to hit ordinary workers, kind of due to the mistakes and the lack of foresight that EU companies had. We also got a comment which touches on the same kind of thing. Temper44 says, "It's because we hate billionaires here in Europe, so the venture capital market is suppressed. We're great at seeding innovation, but then the companies go to the US to scale. That's where the billionaires with risk capital are." So I'll take on this one. I mean, this is the kind of some of the big issues that Steve and Cassandra were talking about in the last Q&A. It's true that the EU isn't a failure at startups, but it is a failure at scale-ups. So it's not really, though, a question of where are all of our billionaires, but why don't our billionaires behave like the ones in the US? Why aren't they doing the same kinds of investments? And the fact is that billionaires just don't have the kind of incentives to invest inside the EU as they do in the US. So in the EU, you pay higher taxes on capital gains. There's more regulation, fewer tax incentives for venture investing, for example. And America also has the kind of institutions that love to invest, that have deep pockets and have, for at least a slice of their investment portfolio, they want to take on something that's a bit more risky and a bit more speculative. The likes of pension funds and university endowment funds and so on, they are a lot more risk tolerant there in the US than in the EU. And they are restricted in the EU, these kinds of funds, from investing in risky projects because the system is designed to keep people's pensions safe from a financial crash. So European innovation policy rather centers on giving innovation grants and for protection for small and mid-sized companies that, for the likes of Germany, for example, are the backbone of the economy. But they're also the ones that are being hardest hit by all of the competition that's coming from China. And they're not focused in the EU on growth capital. And that nurtures clever ideas, but then strangles them with compliance and slow capital cycles once they get to the point where they need to scale up. So, of course, the US just has a lead in areas where it's extraordinarily difficult to catch up. European exchanges, for example, they can't compete with the like of NASDAQ. You can't find the same level of liquidity or investor appetite for risk in somewhere like Frankfurt than you can in the US. So, of course, tech companies list in New York. Arm or BioNTech or Spotify, European companies which decided to invest in the US, sorry, to list in the US rather than in the EU. So you end up with startups taking their ideas abroad. And this isn't going to change until sovereign wealth funds and pension giants are allowed and encouraged to go risk on, and that the long-suggested capital markets union actually materializes. That's where all of the EU operates under a single capital market. That's when you start getting this capital unleashed, but then you have to give up something on the other end for it. And this kind of decision-making which the EU has to come to, is the trade-off worth it? It makes a lot of Europeans nervous that we could inherit some of the bad things from the US, the worsening inequality, the financialization of everything, and even, of course, corporate overreach. And so that's it for this edition of The Dip. I'll be back with Cassandra on Friday, where you can get even more of the latest from global economy, trade, finance, all that stuff. And remember, if you want to send in a question for a Q&A episode just like this one, put your question underneath any of our episodes on YouTube or send them to thedip@dw.com. So until next time, thank you very much for watching or listening to The Dip.